Now, folks, get ready to smile again with Radio's Home Folks, Vic and Sade, written by Paul Reimer. That was the opening sentence by the announcer at the beginning of each 15-minute Vic and Sade radio program. For 10 years during the 1930s, Vic and Sade was the most popular domestic comedy show on radio, averaging about 7 million listeners per show. That is remarkable when you consider the population of the United States at the time was about 123 million people. That would be equivalent to a listening audience today of nearly 19 million. That's huge. The program ran from 1932 to 1944 with all the broadcasts on NBC, except for the last year or two, which was carried by CBS. Vic and Sade Gook were played by Art Van Harvey and Bernardine Flynn. They lived in a little house halfway up the next block in Cooper, Illinois, 40 miles from Peoria. The Gook's adopted son, Rush, was played mostly by Bill Idelson during the series. There were a number of characters with strange names, some who were actually played by actors, but many, like Lottie Sterenzee, Vic's secretary, Jake Gumpox, the garbage man, Smelly Clack, Ruthie Sternbottom, Sadie's friend who often attended wash rag sales at Yamilton's department store, Isigan Fishigan of Shishigan, Michigan, who always called Vic long distance, and Robert and Slobbert Hink, who were identical twins who occasionally sent Vic postcards from unusual places. These characters were never actually heard from. They were just mentioned. Vic worked at plant number 14 of the Consolidated Kitchenware Company. Uncle Fletcher, who was Sade's uncle, always hung out at the Bright Kentucky Hotel to watch the trains go by. Occasionally, there would be an end-of-the-show credit. Sade's Gowns by Yemelson's Department Store, Illinois. Well, on this track, you will hear two more Vic and Sade programs edited back-to-back. The title of the programs are a letter from Aunt Bess from 1937. That's the title. And what makes it interesting is that they just received the letter, and it is December 23rd, 1940. Then Howard, the garbage man's horse, is all decked out with a new and expensive harness. How could the garbage man, Jake Gumpox, afford such a luxury? Could it be that Uncle Fletcher bought it for him? The second episode was originally broadcast on December 31st, 1940. The show is all about the dialogue. Focus on the dialogue and you'll be very smartly entertained. Even today, some 87 years since the series began. Thanks for listening to Vic and Sade. Check out the Vic and Sade playlist for more stories from the little house halfway up the next block. This is Heirloom Radio, a different kind of oldies program. I am your host, John Lovering, and I do appreciate you stopping by.
Well, sir, it's late afternoon as we enter the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here in the living room, we find Mrs. Victor Gook and her son, Mr. Rush Gook. Sade occupies a corner of the Davenport darning socks, and young Rush applies himself without zeal to his algebra textbook at the library table. And now a voice from the kitchen is heard.
Hi, Gary, how's it
going? I got a bone to pick with him.
Huh?
Yep.
Hi. Greetings, Dr. Sleech. Is your mother home, or is she downtown spending all my money?
Sitting right here on the Davenport.
That's fine. Tell her I dropped around the corner for a cigar, but I'm expected back in half an hour.
Okay. I know, but this algebra's getting tough.
Hard problem.
Horrible. I think they're going a little too far when they ask an individual to extract the cube root of a number and then raise it to the seventh power and then construct an equation.
Well, say, isn't this Sadie Gook?
Hello.
It is Sadie Gook, isn't it?
Yeah.
I knew I'd seen that face someplace before. First, I thought it was Q.O. Ducks or Dixon, but then I remembered he had whiskers. Then I figured it must be you.
I dug that old plaid suit out of the clothes closet and sent it to the cleaners like you asked me.
Good. Lots of wear left in that plaid suit.
Rush, go out in the dining room and get what's on top of the buffet.
Uh-huh.
Why, Rush is here, too. Hello, Rex.
Hello.
I didn't see you. I guess you're so small and insignificant and unimportant and worthless.
Trot along, Willie. It's a letter.
Okay.
Letter from Bess.
Oh, really? Walter's kneecap, I trust, is lit up on the twinges. Unsie, I'm convinced, is improving her technique on the pianoforte. The weather in Carberry, I'll
just
say, is mild.
Just a little trivial letter from Bess in the month of August, 1937.
How do you mean, General Upspitch?
Beck, I'd be ashamed.
What for?
Know where I found Bess's letter?
No.
Inside coat pocket of your plaid suit.
Yeah?
It had never been opened.
Really?
It had never been opened.
Here you are, Mom.
Thank you.
Aunt Bess say anything about that big fire they had in Freeport?
Aunt Bess wrote this poor, miserable little letter almost 4 years ago.
Yeah?
Read the postmark.
Carberry, Illinois.
Read down below.
August 1937. Oh, for God's sake.
Oh, kiddo, I remember how that was.
Do you?
Yes, sure.
Where's this been, Mom?
Upstairs in your father's clothes closet.
Yeah, I remember how that was. It was in the summertime, one afternoon. Me and Steve Chestbuddy were walking home from the office. We stopped out in front of the house to chat a little bit. Steve went up the street, and I looked in the mailbox, and there was this letter from Bess. I was holding my hand, and Donahue hollered at me to come over in his front yard and look at some kind of buggy he found. Well, we looked at it and got to talking, and I stuck Bess's letter in my inside coat pocket and forgot all about it. Yeah, and I remember I had on my plaid suit, too. It was a warm afternoon in August.
I know you don't think much of poor Bessie's rotten little letters, but I never realized you'd go so far as...
Hey, now, kiddo, you're not insinuating I hid Bessie's letter on purpose.
Not at all.
Anybody's liable to do that.
August 1937.
Anybody's liable to stick something in their pocket and forget it.
I know.
Sure, look at Uncle Fletcher. Why, George, he forgets to put on his necktie half the time. The other day
you
he
won't
forgot...
tell Aunt Bess about this, will you, Rush?
Tell her about what?
Your father and what he thinks of her letters.
Uh-uh.
I wish you wouldn't. Just watch your step and never let on.
Okay.
Heck, Sage, you act like I'd committed some monstrous crime.
It's all right.
Holy smoke, there's nothing important in the half-wit letter, is there?
None of the half-wit letters my sister writes are important.
Well, my gosh, if I'd been caught throttling some poor
it's
old lady...
It's all right. Forget it. Just one thing, though, I... hope she never finds out. Don't you ever let on, Rush.
You think Aunt Bess would be mad if she knew Gov had accidentally put a letter in his coat pocket and forgot it?
Oh, no. Aunt Bess don't get mad.
Oh.
I believe I'll step over to like knee suppers and see if he feels like a little indoor horseshoe.
I'll go along.
You're supposed to be studying?
I'm all through.
Oh, okay. You get your hat.
Here's what poor Bessie has to say in her little good-for-nothing letter.
Mm-hmm.
A little old good-for-nothing letter. She almost broke her back writing almost 4 years ago that people never even bothered to open.
Of course I never opened it. I don't open mail addressed to other parties. That letter's addressed to you.
Here's what she says.
Mm-hmm.
Carberry, Illinois, August 9th, 1937.
Mm-hmm.
August 9th. 1937.
Well, do you think I'd bit my grandmother's ear off?
I read in the paper where a guy done that. A guy in North Dakota. Paper stated he was a quick-tempered guy, and his grandmother made him mad by refusing to shovel some coal in the cook stove.
I think your mother wants to read, George.
Oh.
Dear sister in all, thought I would write and see how you are feeling. I hope nobody ever tells Aunt Bess about you either, Rush.
Oh.
Break her heart.
Oh.
We are all well, and Walter's kneecap has let up on the twinges. Hasn't the weather been hot, though? We almost sweltered last week. The thermometer's been around 90 even in the evening. So Rush is 11 years old now. I bet he feels quite the grown-up man. What is it?
I'm 14.
This was written in the year 1937.
Oh.
August 9th, 1937.
Why, kiddo, I haven't murdered anybody.
Mr. Geiger up the street has taken to going barefooted these terrible hot days. He often asks after you, by the way. He says, how is your good-looking sister? Ha, ha.
What's that last?
Ha, ha. It's a little laugh.
Huh?
In parenthesis.
Huh?
How is your good-looking sister? Ha, ha.
Huh?
People in around Carberry here think there might be a war in Europe. Certainly hope not. I suppose Rush is enjoying his summer vacation. He'll be in the 7th grade, won't he, when he goes back to school.
Cut out the feeble-minded tittering, Sam. I want to hear Aunt Bess's interesting letter. I want to listen to you giggle and guffaw. Continue, kiddo. I'll see that he behaves himself.
Yunsi has started taking piano lessons at last. Poor little tyke. Her hands are too small to stretch an octave. Miss Agnes Peterson is her teacher. I don't know whether you remember Agnes or not. You met her at church one Sunday, but you met so many folks, probably they're mixed up in your mind. Anyway, she's considered quite a good piano teacher. She only has the one leg, so when she plays a piece, she puts a flat iron on the loud pedal. How is Victor? I hope it's cool in his office. Lands, I've never seen it so hot. Well, Ed Rackerman got the job he was after in Dubuque.
Dead, isn't it?
What?
Ain't Ed Rackerman dead?
I don't know Ed Rackerman.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of Joe Rackerman. Yeah, guess I am. Joe Rackerman.
I know a Pete Rackerman. Not bright. Say hello to him and he goes...
Well, Ed Rackerman got the job he was after in Dubuque. Supposed to pay very good money. He and his family move away from Carberry the first of the week. How is Victor's sore foot? Ha ha.
Sore foot?
What?
Sore foot?
Yes.
I don't remember having any sore foot.
This was in 1937.
I don't remember having any sore foot in 1937.
I expect Bessie tells fibs.
Why does she tack ha-ha on there?
Got no better sense, I guess.
Oh, but there's nothing funny about a guy having a sore foot.
Bessie's mean.
Oh, Exy.
The reason I didn't answer your last nice letter sooner was because Walter carried it around in his coat pocket several days.
There you are. Other guys accidentally forget stuff.
Seems he took it out of the mailbox and stuck it in his pocket and never remembered he had it.
Sure.
I can't get it in my head. The year 1937 is half over. Reminds me how old I'm getting. Ha ha.
Ha ha. Quiet, Rush.
Just think. That little scalawag of a Rush is 11.
Oh.
Well, mate, I guess I've done enough chattering. Sit down and write me a long letter real soon. And in the meantime, try to keep cool. Love to all. Bess.
Very nice letter.
Ah.
A very, very nice letter.
Mm.
So Tom Hackerman moves to Dubuque next week, does he?
Ed Rackerman.
Yeah, Ed Rackerman. Moves to Dubuque. Oh, good.
Mm.
I always enjoy hearing the news from Carberry. Bess writes a darn interesting letter.
August 9th,
1937.
August 9th, 1937. Poor Bess.
Which concludes another brief interlude, the small house halfway up in the next block. Well, sir, it's late afternoon as our scene opens now, and here in the living room of the small house halfway up the next block, we find Mr. Victor Gook and young Mr. Rush Gook. Vic lounges in his easy chair, staring vacantly at the bookcase, while Rush, on the davenport, reads aloud from a volume of stirring fiction.
Sir Lieutenant Clinton Stanley showed no trace of fear as he watched the slow approach of the counterfeiting South Sea Islanders. Lady Margaret, on the other hand, was frantic with apprehension. "We shall be assassinated, sweetheart," she quavered. "Perhaps so," rejoined the handsome young officer, "but not without a fight. Shall we enjoy a hug and kiss before we are attacked by these rascals?" The beautiful woman gazed down at her fashionable French spats. "As you please," she murmured, and Third Lieutenant Stanley's face glowed ruddily with hungry anticipation. At this moment, the chief of the counterfeit and South Sea Islanders emitted a horrible shriek.
Well, Miss Holmes.
Huh? Is she?
I heard the back door open.
Counterfeit and South Sea Islanders, maybe.
Here it is. Let's invite him to share a hug and a kiss.
Rush?
Hi.
Your father in there?
Not right now, Sadie, but I'm expected any minute. I stepped around the corner to get my shoes half-soled.
Lady Margaret stifled a little scream. "Hurry up with that hug and kiss," snapped her sweetheart.
extending his arms and thrusting forward his chin. The beautiful
oh,
woman.
Oh, heck with that. Greetings, Dr. Sleech.
Greetings. How much does harness cost?
Harness?
Horse harness.
That is the most peculiar question to hurl at a fellow out of a blue sky.
Do you know?
What horse harness costs?
You, Rush?
It seems to me I did know at one time. I believe I asked Harry Plink down at the lumber company the
Seen
price.
Mr. Gumpox today?
No.
Quite a grand sight.
Did he?
I bumped into him in the alley just now. His horse is all decked out in fancy new harness.
Indeed.
Expensive-looking harness. Brass doodads on the bridle and trash. I chatted with Mr. Gumpox a minute and asked him what on earth, and he said the harness was the gift of an anonymous donor. An anonymous donor.
Well, don't look at me. I have
well, you know who I suspect, don't you?
Jackson L. Cunningham, alias Dave Garraway of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the man with the light gray trousers.
Uncle Fletcher.
Beg pardon?
I suspect Uncle Fletcher. Go so far as to say I know it's Uncle Fletcher. Sounds just like him.
Hmm.
Don't it sound just like him?
Well, I'd say so, Mom. Of all the individuals I'm acquainted with that present the garbage man with fancy horse harness for his horse, Uncle Fletcher...
Fills the bill, exactly. Here's what Mr. Gumpox told me. He said this enormous package box arrived by express. Inside was the fancy harness. And the only clue to who sent it was a little card that said, from an anonymous donor.
Howard's harness was in tatters.
Sure.
Mr. Gumpox was even using chunks of clothesline to hold it together.
Sure.
And Uncle Fletcher admires Mr. Gumpox.
Uncle Fletcher admires Mr. Gumpox, and Uncle Fletcher's got a heart as big as a tub, and Mr. Gumpox has been just terrible, terrible nice to him since he moved here from Dixon. And I'll just bet anybody 85 cents Uncle Fletcher sent away and bought that expensive harness for Howard.
No, I wouldn't doubt it.
I know it.
You seem upset, kiddo.
Well, I am upset. You should see that harness Howard's got on once. Brass thingamadoodles all the way up and down his back. The do-funny in his mouth is a... what you call a do-funny a horse holds in his mouth?
Yeah.
Well, that do-funny looks like silver. And the bridle and the lines and trash are made out of the heaviest, richest, most expensive-looking leather I ever saw in my life. Person would think Howard was a circus horse. Why, I bet... several hundred dollars.
You bet the new equipment costs several hundred dollars?
Well, it could, couldn't it?
Possibly. I haven't anything to go by in such
a... Oh, matter. You should see it once. Why, maybe $1,000.
Oh, come now, kid.
Well,
for $1,000, you could buy a harness, horse, wagon, ice cream cone, suit of clothes, ton of coal, dish of asparagus...
Not always, Doug. I've heard of cowboy saddles that cost $5,000. $5,000 for just a saddle.
You have such a saddle upstairs, no doubt.
No, but I've read in magazines.
Yeah, about a fella that put on his hat and then pulled his hat down over his ears. Sure, I read the same magazine. Shucks, kiddo, Uncle Fletcher's about as wise a bird as they come. Oh, he has his eccentricities and all, but when it comes to shrewdness...
Who was going to send us 11 barrels of oysters? Who was going to send us a dozen rails from the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad that would have weighed several hundred tons? Uncle Fletcher, that wise old bird, that shrewd fella.
Okay, but in this instance...
In this instance, he bought the garbage man a present that I'll bet you my undershirt cost lots and lots of money.
It's his money.
Mm-hmm. Rush's money in Rush's savings account down at Rush's bank is Rush's money. But do we allow Rush to...
Talking about Rush now, Uncle Fletcher is a different package of oyster crackers.
Uncle Fletcher is my uncle, and I'm the only relative in this town he's got to look after him. I feel responsible, Vic. I don't say he's childish and simple in the head and has to have a nurse or anything, but I do say he needs...
Supervision.
That's it, Willie. Supervision. I say he needs supervision.
Do you think he'd stand for any supervision? I notice when his landlady, Mrs. Keller, tries any high-class supervision, the old boy jumps on her like a load of bricks.
That's true, but...
Uncle Fletcher is gentle and obliging and anxious to please, but if he feels the iron hand in the velvet glove tapping him on the shoulder, he gets up on his hind legs.
Well, that's true, Vic. That's perfectly true, and it's the reason why I'm upset. Like I say, I'm his niece, and I feel responsible for his actions. But how can I go about being responsible? If he feels like going to work and
given the garbage man a present that cost $69,000, my hands are tied.
Yes, I'm afraid they are.
Must I stand by and watch him do crazy stuff?
I think you exaggerate the crazy stuff he does.
Now, Vic, you should see that new harness of Howard's.
I'd like to.
Howard feel pretty proud in his new outfit, ma'am?
Just more than strutting along the alley. Person to take him for a circus horse. Person actually would.
How about Mr. Gumpox? I bet he feels like the dude.
Oh, got his chest puffed out 6 miles.
I bet.
You know that new sign he's got tacked on the side of the garbage wagon?
No riders?
Yeah. Well, he's added to that sign. In little letters up above the big ones, it says, "We cordially invite."
We cordially invite?
Uh-huh.
We cordially invite no rider?
Oh, yeah.
We cordially invite no rider.
And the sign is scrubbed and polished till who laid the chunk.
Kiddo, you don't know what Uncle Fletcher can afford and what he can't afford, do you?
Oh, I don't know how much money he's got, no.
Well, there you are. Maybe he's rich as my undershirt.
He could be. He's always been awful close-mouthed about his affairs. Beth and I have talked about it many a time. Whether he's real well-fixed or whether he's just got enough to get by on, we haven't the slightest notion.
Okay, fine. I say that if a man could handle his own business without assistance or interference through the years, it shows he's pretty capable in the common sense department.
I say so, too.
I appreciate how you mean.
Of course, you figure as his niece, it's more or less up to you to see that he don't stub his toe or involve himself.
Yeah. Well, all right. We'll say no more about it.
I'm convinced Uncle Fletcher knows what he's doing.
All right. But next time he pulls any fancy stunts like this, I am going to doctor up some scheme to make him behave. You have to trot to the store, Sonny Jim.
Okay. Right now?
Well, I'll hop to the kitchen and fix the list.
Okay.
Come when I holler.
Okay.
What's the sign say on Gumpox's garbage wagon?
We cordially invite no riders.
A puzzling notice to the public.
Yeah.
We cordially invite no riders. I don't think we have to worry about Uncle Fletcher.
No, he can take care of himself.
Sharp as a tack.
Well, I'll say. Want me to read some more Third Lieutenant Stanley?
Uh-uh.
It starts getting exciting.
Don't bother.
They have a big fight.
Read it to me some other day.
The handsome young officer rolled up his sleeves and trouser legs, preparatory to smiting the leader of the counterfeit in the South Sea Islanders. Lady Margaret hovered at a little distance, blubbering softly. "Hey, you, how about that good old hug and kiss?" cried Third Lieutenant Stanley suddenly. And the beautiful woman trotted across the clearing, her china blue eyes aglow.
Which concludes another brief interlude at the small house halfway up in the next block.